Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-1045, C-SPAN et al. Petitioners versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Stokler for the petitioners, Mr. Palmore for the respondents, Mr. Goodman for the interveners.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Bruce Stokler, and I represent petitioners here, Program Networks, C-SPAN, Discovery Networks, et al., and I've asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Over 20 years ago, this court recognized that FCC-imposed carriage regulations like the duplicative carriage regulations at issue here abridged the First Amendment rights of programmers like my clients due to the fact that a broadcaster is guaranteed a channel even if carriage effectively bumps a programmer. The Supreme Court in the Turner decisions in the mid-1990s held that mandatory carriage requirements directly interfere with free speech rights of cable programmers by rendering it more difficult for cable programmers to compete for carriage on the limited channels remaining after must-carry stations are given their channels. Let me be clear at the outset about what our position is, as the Commission's actions and purported reasoning, in our view, have not been. FCC carriage regulations that require a cable operator to reserve capacity, deliver the same broadcast station twice to subscribers, violates the First Amendment rights of cable programmers, particularly whereas here there was no problem needing to be solved, where there was a solution available to them that did not require double or duplicative carriage.
And so, is your position just on this threshold standing question that necessarily as a matter of law your clients have standing?
I believe that's derivable from the Supreme Court's Turner decision and their view as they addressed the First Amendment harm of cable program networks, where they understood that every time an opportunity to reach an audience was taken away by the must-carry rules, a First Amendment abridgment existed. And, of course, in the Turner decision, the Supreme Court held by the 5-4 margin it was justified under intermediate scrutiny. Well, this court, Judge Rogers, in its Quincy decision, also recognized two other things that I think support the standing of petitioners here. The first is that they recognize that because these regulations are never directly imposed or implemented against cable programmers, they have standing at this time when regulations are promulgated to challenge it. And secondly, that it was not necessary for standing, that there be certainty that it would be C-SPAN or Discovery or TV One or any particular cable network that would get the spot if the must-carry rules weren't taking it off the marketplace of ideas and the economic marketplace that otherwise exists out there.
Don't you have a pretty serious causation and redressability problem here? Because as I understand it, whether these injure you turn not so much on what the FCC does, but on how cable operators react to what choices they make. Right? I mean, first of all, haven't they all said that they'll do this anyway, no matter what the FCC does or no matter what we do?
Well, Your Honor, as you know in the record in that regard, the industry has indicated at various points to Congress and publicly that they were likely to make the transition easier for their subscribers and do something very similar. It is a different,
They'll do the same thing.
I'm sorry?
They said they'll do exactly the same. This is their proposal, which the commission adopted. And they've said, haven't
it was
they
the
said,
trade association's proposal?
Yeah, and haven't they said they'll implement this no matter what happens here?
But there's a big difference, isn't there, Your Honor, between a government mandate and something that, for whatever reason, operators indicated that they intend to do in the marketplace, but think marketplace conditions could change, particularly over a three-year period of time. And, of course, the difference is if there's a government mandate, that wouldn't matter. Our opportunity would be totally foreclosed in that regard by the government mandate itself.
Well, the problem is, though, even if we were to vacate the commission's decisions, the operators would do this anyway.
They may.
So it wouldn't. Well, no, they said they would.
The trade association said they would. Yes, Your Honor. But we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of operators who operate how many systems? And obviously, I would expect the cable program networks would not engage here in a futile act. They obviously believe that if their injury were in fact redressed, that there be opportunities, maybe not as many as they might in other circumstances, where they have the opportunity to convince an operator that they should be the one to be able to reach their audience. And that's normally the case, that it shouldn't be the government who decides that. That's the very rare exception. It should be the marketplace of ideas and the economic marketplace.
And doesn't the extent of your injury also turn on how cable operators decide to comply with these regulations, that is, whether they go all digital or not?
Well, to the degree they go all digital,
you don't have a problem.
We would no longer have a problem until...
And we don't know how many are going to do that, do we?
That's right. That's because, of course, the government, the FCC here, didn't compile a record that allows us to assess this.
The burden of showing standing is on you.
Right.
The government doesn't have the burden of showing that you don't have standing.
The burden of standing is on us, Your Honor, and we, of course, believe we've met it. But assuming for the moment that we have met standing, the burden is certainly on the government to establish a record that shows the need for them to have intervened and acted. And my point is that assuming for the moment that we have standing, which I've laid out at least our arguments as to why we believe we do, stemming primarily and significantly from the discussion of cable programmers' injury in the Turner decisions, also the decisions of this court, then the fact that we don't know how many instances of any of this stuff would occur is a failure by the FCC.
And is
one of the reasons why the order, in our view, cannot withstand review. Yes, Your Honor.
Given the pledge by the operators, Is it your position that the court cannot rely on that pledge because circumstances may change, or that the association can't bind individual operators, or that the court should assume there is some operator out there that will not follow this pledge?
That, in fact, to the degree there's a pledge, there was no need for government action to begin with, and as such, to turn that situation into a government-imposed requirement where the government is limited by the First Amendment and by the Administrative Procedure Act was clear error by the FCC. I think that without choosing among your alternatives, on my feet, Your Honor, I think it is clear for a combination of those reasons, unlike the hypothetical Judge Tatel posed, I don't think the voluntary statements by the trade association foreclose anything here.
Well, we have this in-bank case on standing that talks about the problem a party faces where the injury relies on the actions of third parties. And that's what I'm trying to focus on.
I understand. And I guess, my basic position in that regard is that the court should turn for guidance in here as a starting point to the Turner decision, it's plural, and how the Turner decision approached the issue of First Amendment injury to cable programmers by these regulations. And, of course, the same considerations or issues that you've raised, other than the voluntary commitment, exist there as well. That is,
I understand your point in terms that we don't need mathematical certainty here. That the commission itself over the years has made findings that demonstrate injury to you. And certainly there's language in these Supreme Court opinions to the same effect. But the argument that's being posed here is, in a sense, that the world has changed. The rule or the pledge by the operators reflects an incentive for them to go all digital, and therefore they would end up giving your clients even greater opportunities than they have now to get their programs on the air. And sort of in that environment, is it enough for us to rely on these old statements and the absence of any indication that there's one operator out there who would do something differently?
Your Honor, I understand the question. I would respond to it in this way. I don't think the record before you indicates that the world, in fact, has changed or is likely to change in the three-year period this rule exists, that operators of the cable industry will and am going all digital. To the contrary, I think the administrative record was made clear by the trade association, by the larger cable operators who participated in the administrative proceeding. Their comments are all in the joint appendix for convenience, that suggested that the all digital option was characterized by one of them as a Hobson's choice, that in point, in fact, it was too expensive. And in fact, you know, if we focused on that just for a second, it also shows, I think, the illogical, the commission's approach to this whole thing to begin with, because to the degree they permitted a cable operator to go to the all digital option, then an owner like me of an analog television station is going to need a box to get access to all these must-carry stations. And why is that sufficient in the all-digital option while it wasn't sufficient in all the other options? There's an internal contradiction in the commission's whole approach to the all-digital to begin with, and I think they knew it was, at least during this period of time, an empty gesture as opposed to the world having changed. Yes, sir.
I want to see if I understand the impact of this fourth order that the commission brought to our attention in its Rule 20HA letter.
Yes, understood.
Yeah. Do I understand it to mean that now the dual transmission requirement now applies only to large hybrid operators who receive high HD signals, right? That's one category.
Well, I think that's a net result, but I think there's several steps in the commission's most recent order to get there.
That's the consequence of this.
That's one of the consequences, yes.
Do you know how many operators fall into that category or are likely to?
Well, again, we don't know. Strike that. Certainly, in terms of the waiver, I believe that the two largest cable operators, Comcast and Time Warner, fall into that category. And again, I'll defer in the first instance to counsel for the FCC, who obviously perhaps had a record before them, which is sort of undisclosed. But in terms of some of the other pieces, larger systems owned by other operators also will fall under that category. For example, and at least my own takeaway is, for example, the Fairfax County system of Cox would not be exempt, just to use an illustration from this neck of the woods.
And why is that?
Because it's too large a system. It's a combination of systems of a certain size, and then also you have to be an operator of a certain size to be exempt.
And what about this other category of any hybrid operator of any size that has subscribers with TVs that can't receive analog?
Right.
Do those exist today?
Judge Tatel, again, I assume the FCC would not do an action in futility. Uh-huh. My understanding is those boxes exist, but there's no record before, you know,
you
in
mean
this
the
docket
converter
before
box.
The court
you
to know whether it's 1,000 boxes or 10 million boxes like that. Uh-huh. And so I'm not in a position to represent anything factually in that regard to you.
And just one other factual question. This applies only to must carry, right?
Correct. It does not apply to retransmission consent.
So what effect does that have? What I'm thinking about is I'm thinking through your claim that this regulation will injure your client. Does the fact that it applies, and by the way, must carry is, that's a significant minority, correct?
I think that much I can factually represent to you is that everyone agrees that most broadcast stations opt for retransmission consent. Right. The broadcast stations that actually haven't, the bigger audiences, opt for retransmission consent.
So doesn't that suggest that this regulation will really only have a relatively minor impact?
Well, again, it would depend, I guess, if your view of minor. From my client's perspective, no, because these are the opportunities they have to expand.
What I'm getting at is, you know, injury under Article III standing can't be speculative. It has to be firm. You have to have evidence of injury.
But First Amendment injury occurs, we would argue, as the Turner Court held, every time that opportunity doesn't exist for a free choice by the operator of exercising its editorial discretion and a free opportunity for us to try to reach an audience. And it's clear that there is still far more speakers than there is capacity. So to the degree we are doubling capacity of the must-carry, that the must-carry stations pick up, that is a First Amendment injury, and I think that is clearly and safely Article III standing.
How would your converter box alternative work? Wouldn't be required that the consumer take the converter box.
No, right? And I don't think that's what the statute requires either, Your Honor. That is, it's to be offered, and if someone wants a converter box, and obviously,
but the required converter box as opposed to an offered converter box would be better from a First Amendment perspective, right?
I'm not sure I may be able to argue that one both ways, but I don't think the statute has ever required it until now, and I think there's a lot of FCC jurisprudence that suggests that under the statute, the viewability statute.
You don't have an answer whether the required converter box would be better from a First Amendment perspective than dual carriage?
Then dual carriage, it certainly would be better. Of course it would be. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. And
isn't it possible, just to follow up on that, that if a large percentage of cable operators select all digital, that even if some continue to transmit analog signals, the net result will be more channels than there are today.
Clearly, right? A digital system has more capacity to carry more things, which is why the FCC's order, the net effect of which, taking more bandwidth spectrum shelf space here, saying that if you just had a requirement to carry it once and carry it in digital, your point would be exactly right, Judge Tatel. But when it becomes digital and analog, or HD and digital.
I understand that. No, my only point is that if, let's assume when this is all done, and we're in March, and it's possible that through the choices the cable operators make, that is, if many of them go all digital, even though some do remain hybrid and have to use two channels, one for digital and one for analog, that the net result in March will be more channels than there are today, more channel capacity than there is today.
Your Honor, as a theoretical matter, I would agree with you. I think the flaw in that analysis is that there's nothing in the record, and there's nothing that I understand about the state of the industry. In fact, the record is to the contrary, that a great majority or very many at all systems will be all digital in March, or all digital during the period of time that this regulation initially will be in effect. And so, you know, certainly an all digital world means that less capacity, less shelf space is taken for any particular channel. Well, but if there would be
in the commission's brief at page 31,
yes, sir,
they list operators who either have or will go all digital.
Out of 10,000 cable systems, they listed
120 operators. And you didn't respond to that at all in your reply brief. At least I didn't see it.
Well, Your Honor, because I think we responded on a more macro basis. But the point is, that's 120 actually out of 10,000. It's not like every one of those operators are going.
Well, aren't many of the 10,000 exempt under the fourth order now?
All of a sudden, that's post the brief as well. Right. My understanding is about all.
You're not suggesting we can't consider that, are you?
Of course not.
Oh, okay. Am I right that many of the 10,000 are exempt now?
I think.
Do you know how many, by the way?
No, I don't, Your Honor, because the record doesn't show us. Uh-huh. I imagine it may be, in terms of systems, a couple thousand. In terms of percentage of subscribers, far less. My understanding that the percentage of subscribers that will be subscribers to all digital systems are going to be less than 5%. Less than 5%.
Is that in the record?
I think so.
Where?
In the comments that were filed by the
maybe you can point us to that when you
let me take that as homework during the next 15 minutes.
On the statutory section at issue here,
yes, Your Honor,
the viewability section, there are three key sentences, right? And I'm with you if it ends after two sentences, but how do you make sense of the third sentence? This is 614E7, the offer to provide a converter box, if your interpretation of the second sentence is correct.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, I think, in fact,
well, I think it was the FCC's big argument against your interpretation here was that the third sentence wouldn't make any sense. It would be superfluous if your interpretation of the second sentence were correct.
I don't think that's obviously the way I would interpret the statute and the way the FCC interpreted the statute heretofore. That, you know, that is, in 2001, to use an example, when, as part of the transition, they said it was perfectly permissible for an early adapter must carry station to decide just to go digital, even though they would not be available to analog systems, so long as the cable operator informed the subscriber that that was the case. Similarly, in the WLIG decision, the commission in 1993, which is right after they first did their first set of regulations to promulgate, execute on this section, they also said the same thing. So I don't think that the interpretation that we advance is an illogical one. In fact, it had been the FCC's interpretation before this set of orders, and it's an interpretation, of course, that avoids all of these duplicative carriage issues.
Well, that's a stronger point. I agree.
I think my time is way up, Your Honor. Hopefully I'll get a little bit for rebuttal.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Joseph Palmore here on behalf of respondents. I'd like to go directly to the threshold issue of standing that the court questioned Mr. Sokler about. As the court noted, the cable programmers who are here before you today are not the parties that are directly regulated by this order. Cable operators are, and they're not in court today.
Why the cable programmers have standing in Turner?
There was no standing finding in Turner. In Turner, there was a statement that there was, and that was a decision on summary judgment in against the cable programmers. There was a general statement there of an abstract injury, but there was no holding that meant that any particular cable programmer would have standing to challenge any conceivable must-carry regulation in perpetuity. That doesn't relieve the petitioners here of their obligation under Lujan and this court's cases involving third-party standing to explain why the harm they're complaining of is not caused by the independent decisions of parties who are not before the court. And as the court's questioning demonstrated, there are several aspects to this. There's kind of a complex decision tree that stands between petitioners and their theory of harm, and at each branch of that tree, there's an independent decision by a cable operator. One of them was one that Judge Tatel focused on, which was the all-digital option under the commission's order. Everyone agrees that to the extent that a cable operator goes all-digital, that actually increases bandwidth and potentially increases opportunities for petitioners to place their programming. So even to the extent that there might be an incremental loss on the hybrid system side of the equation, petitioners here have made no showing, and they bear the burden of standing. They didn't go into this issue in the reply brief at all. They've made no showing that on net they are actually harmed by this order, given the all-digital option that's created by the commission. Even for hybrid systems, they haven't made a showing, because as the court picked up upon, after the order was issued here, the NCTA, which is the Major Trade Association of the Major Cable Operators, said that its members would comply with the carriage rules adopted by the commission in this order, whether petitioners prevail in this case or not.
Are all operators members of that association?
No. I think all the major operators are. To the extent there are small operators that are not members of NCTA, many of them have now been exempted from the requirement to carry high-definition signals.
I was going to ask you, what percentage of cable subscribers are subscribed to the operators that are now exempt?
Judge Tatel, I don't believe that number is in the record. I've been informed by the staff that it's actually a majority of cable operators majority of cable systems are now exempt.
No, I wasn't asking about systems.
I understand. So it's not a majority of subscribers, because these are typically systems that serve smaller populations. But I don't think those precise numbers, unfortunately, are not part of the record.
I wouldn't be wrong if I assumed that most cable subscribers, the overwhelming majority of cable subscribers, subscribe from companies that are still subject to these regulations.
To the extent that those companies don't go all digital,
correct.
That's right. They would not be exempt. Yeah. But those are the companies that typically would be members of the NCTA, which is the trade association of the large cable operators, which says that they are going to follow these rules regardless of what happens in this case.
So if the government tells a library or bookstore that a certain percentage of books in the library or bookstore have to be from local authors, other publishers and authors who are bounced out of bookstores and libraries don't have standing?
I don't know that would be the case. I think at least
why not? That's your theory.
I think the plaintiff would have the burden of explaining why they had standing. And in this case, the petitioners haven't even tried. When we in our brief pointed out this voluntary commitment, as far as I read their reply brief, they said, you're right, this is completely unnecessary. They say that in advancing their APA claim, but of course, if they don't have standing, they never get to the APA claim. So they bore the burden of articulating what their injury was.
Both of you have inconsistencies on your merits versus your standing arguments.
I don't think so, Judge Kavanaugh, because the reasonableness of a commission order is evaluated on the record at the time the order is adopted. At the time the order was adopted, the cable industry vociferously opposed the proposal here. The Comcast and NCTA comments, both of which are in the joint appendix, showed that what they wanted to be able to do was to, in a sense, demote must-carry stations to the digital tier, thus making them non-viewable for analog customers. That was the position of the cable industry at the time the commission acted, and the reasonableness of the commission's action has to be evaluated upon the record at the time. Standing, however, later breaking developments can be taken into account when...
So why not go with the converter box alternative? Isn't that much better from a First Amendment standpoint?
Well, that is, for many cable operators, that will be the alternative. So to the extent a cable operator wants
to
go all digital...
Right, but not for the hybrids.
Not for the hybrids, because...
Why couldn't the converter box option be used for the hybrids?
Well, that would have essentially been a commission mandate that all cable systems go all digital. The cable industry did vociferously oppose that. The commission wanted to preserve some flexibility for the industry. The industry said there are 40 million analog cable customers, and they're going to—
Explain the technology there. Why would that require that?
Sure. Because the purpose of the box is to convert a digital signal so that it can be viewed on an analog receiver. So for a customer who does not have a digital-ready TV, has an older TV—
It subscribes to a hybrid—
Subscribes to a hybrid system. I'm one of these people. I don't have a cable box. I just plug the cable into the back of the TV, and I watch cable on my analog television. But to the extent that the—
Could converter boxes be used in that situation?
To provide digital signals, yes. So there's a cable operator that deploys—
So couldn't the converter box be used instead of requiring dual carriage?
It could, but to the extent that a cable,
and from a First Amendment standpoint, assuming they're standing and assuming the cable programmers have First Amendment rights here, isn't that a much less restrictive First Amendment problematic alternative?
Well, of course, this is an intermediate scrutiny case, so the presence of a less restrictive alternative, it doesn't really change the analysis. The cable operators would, the commission had done that, the cable operators would be at the table here today, and they would have said that is not a less restrictive alternative, that would have imposed great expense on them. They wanted the flexibility to maintain hybrid systems for some time. A majority of cable customers today are analog cable customers. So the industry is moving toward—
It would be a great expense on them, but it wouldn't be an affect anyone's First Amendment rights, correct?
Well, they argued in the record below that that would have affected their First Amendment rights, that kind of mandate. Well, far be it from me to articulate the cable industry's theory of First Amendment damage here, Your Honor, but that would have been vociferously opposed. And the commission concluded that there was really no reason to do that, that it wanted to create the opportunity for these signals—
Better to crowd out other stations than to choose an alternative that would provide the same benefits to consumers?
Well, of course, petitioners haven't made any showing that they're going to be crowded out, given the issues that we've talked about.
Assume logic controls and that some will be crowded out. Why not choose that option rather than— why not choose the converter box option rather than crowding out cable programmers some?
I think that the practicalities of that, the commission had to look at the state of the market, had to look at the fact that there were 40 million customers who did not have cable boxes because they remained analog. It looked at statements from the cable industry saying that this was going to remain the state of play for quite some time, that many customers did not want to have cable boxes. They wanted to remain analog, that the market should govern this transition from analog to digital on the cable side of things. So what the commission said was it put the choice in the hands of the cable operators. Many of those cable operators, and this is in footnote 151 of the order where it discusses that—
Actually, there's no real choice for the cable operators who are hybrid.
They can go all digital, and many have. That's footnote 151, in fact, which provides a citation.
But while they're hybrid, there's no choice. They have to provide— they have to do dual carriage, correct?
They what the viewability statute requires.
Or even triple.
They have to carry— No, Your Honor. They have to carry a viewable signal of all must carry channels. That's what this viewability order requires. That's what the commission construed the language of 614b7, and Your Honor noticed the difference between sentence 2 and sentence 3 there. That's a mandatory obligation. So what the commission said was those analog hybrid systems have to provide a viewable signal of all must carry stations. These stations can't be demoted to a digital tier that's more expensive.
Converter box would do that.
If they were to go all digital,
converter box would do that even for the hybrid systems, correct?
Then they wouldn't be a hybrid system, Your Honor. They would be an all digital system. So that route is available. There would be no reason for a cable system to provide a converter box just for purposes of must carry. If they're going to provide a digital to analog converter box to every customer, they then will send all of their signals over the system in digital, and they will be an all digital system, and they'll garner the benefits of the bandwidth savings that we've talked about.
They have to provide it to customers with analog TVs. Not—
You're right, Your Honor, because customers with digital TVs can receive digital signals without the box, but there are many, many analog TVs still out there. Another aspect of the standing issue here is that even to the extent there were bandwidth savings, there's no showing by petitioners here that the cable systems would use that bandwidth saving for traditional television programming of the kind that petitioners provide. The petitioner's own amici at page 8 of their brief talk about all the different uses of bandwidth that cable operators use, for instance, telephone, high-speed internet access, video on demand. Again, that's an independent choice of cable operators that puts the harm and the redressability of petitioners in the speculative realm here. Finally,
could I just ask a question?
Sure.
So I understand what the agency's position is. If the regulated party issues a statement saying, here's what we're going to do, regardless of what the commission does, and the commission ends up doing what the regulated party says it's going to do anyway, is it the commission's position that under those circumstances there could be no standing?
No, I think the petitioners would bear the burden of explaining why they had standing. I'm not saying they would never, it's inconceivable that there would be standing under those circumstances. Here, of course, the statement came after the order was adopted. But I think there is a minimum threshold. And I think that Quincy Cable,
their argument, as I understand it, is, look, the Supreme Court has recognized that any time you have a must-carry, there's a burden on programmers' speech. And what more do they have to show?
They have to show that their speech is burdened. That was a general statement by the court. It's not tailored to these particular petitioners. And I think
how would any excluded programmer ever make that showing?
I think you look at footnote 24 of the Quincy Cable decision, and it shows you how they would make that showing. TBS, in that case, had statements from cable operators saying, but for these must-carry rules, we would carry TBS. And that's what this court relied on to establish standing.
It's easier to find than the reverse that we're looking for here. That's what I'm trying to understand. In other words, are you saying that the petitioners would have to, I suppose, survey the field, these 10,000, and say, who's not going to do this? Who's not going along with the pledge?
I don't think this court has to decide where exactly to draw the line, because I don't think they've even attempted to make the showing here. I think they have to come up with something. They have to articulate.
Their argument is, as I understand it in part, is that there's no record here on which they could rely to make this showing. So in effect, the burden is simply they have to go out and do this survey and find out all this information to be able to respond to the types of questions we're asking today.
Well,
sometimes
this court does require parties to come forward with affidavits and collect information on standing.
No, I understand that totally. And I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask was, in light of the fourth order, would it be appropriate to allow petitioners an opportunity to submit further information on standing?
I don't think so under this court's precedence, because we articulated a standing argument in our respondents' brief. The intervenors, NAB, did the same. And the reply brief didn't really respond meaningfully to several of the showings. And I think under this...
You say it didn't meaningfully respond, and what I'm trying to understand is they cite not only these Supreme Court decisions, they cite the commission's own prior statements, all right, repeatedly.
Statements of abstract injury, you're right, Your Honor.
Not abstract injury, saying there's First Amendment injury whenever you burden, all right, through these must-carry provisions. And so the commission has acknowledged this. And given this truism that the commission has acknowledged repeatedly, why is there a further burden on the petitioners?
Because the existence of a right in the abstract doesn't tell you anything about a particular petitioner's ability to vindicate that right in court. Under Lujan and under this court's precedents.
I know, but they make, I think, the response, they're not a gadfly in this field. These are major players.
Lujan is an Article III case. There's no C-SPAN exception to Article III.
I totally understand, but I'm just wondering where you have the commission repeatedly acknowledging this. Here you have major players in the programming arena. I know you're a four-part test, but I just wonder how far they have to go here.
Well, I think they were obligated to come forward with something in their reply brief. Those statements of abstract injury, of course, came before the voluntary commitment of the NCTA. They didn't reflect the other uses of cable bandwidth. They didn't have anything to do with particular petitioners, as footnote 24 of the Quincy Cable talks about particular petitioner's obligation.
What I'm trying to understand under your thesis is that then the petitioners would have to be able to show, and I don't know how they would show, that an operator who has pledged would make a statement that could be filed in court that they would enter a contract for traditional programming with at least one of petitioner's members. Is that what you would require?
It's something like that. I mean, to the extent they can't find a cable operator who will say, yes, despite our pledge, we would actually not follow the rules, then they haven't established their standing.
That's their burden.
I think they have to show. I think they have to show something. Yes, they have to show something specific to these petitioners that they would be harmed by this order, and that vacatur of the order would redress that harm. If I could just very briefly touch on the statutory issue, because Judge Kavanaugh went to this with Mr. Sokler. And I think it's important to look at all three sentences of 614b7 in the event that the court gets past standing and goes to that. The first sentence says, signals carried in fulfillment of the requirement of this section shall be provided to every subscriber of a cable system. That's a simple requirement that the signal has to be provided. The second sentence says, such signals, the signals that are merely provided pursuant to the first sentence, shall be viewable via cable on all television receivers that are connected by the cable company. The third sentence then establishes a narrow carve-out to the second sentence, and it says, under a couple limited circumstances, if a user makes his own connection, goes out to Radio Shack, gets some coaxial cable, and runs his own connection to his garage, to his television set there, the cable operator authorizes that additional user-installed connection. In that event, the optional box is enough to establish viewability. It's a narrow carve-out. The petitioner's position is that the optional box is actually the general rule. But I didn't hear Mr. Sokler offer any account for what work the third sentence does in the world as he sees it, in which the optional box is the general rule. There would have been no need for this narrowly circumscribed exception.
Of course, there's no viewability requirement for non-commercial stations, correct?
The same language doesn't appear in the statute. The statute does, however, say the signals have to be available.
Nothing remotely like this language.
I would say the non-commercial section says the signals have to be available. The petitioner's argument on this point is waived. No party below argued that non-commercial stations should be treated differently from commercial stations. We noted that in our brief and cited Section 405 of the Communications Act, and petitioners responded, offered no citation to any argument in the record that preserved this issue. But I think it was certainly, I think for commercial stations, I think it's a mandatory obligation. Box optional is actually foreclosed by the statute. Under the non-commercial setting, it perhaps is ambiguous, but the commission was certainly...
Is this ambiguous, or is this a step one?
I think for commercial stations, it's a step one case in terms of viewability being mandatory. Now, how you actually get there...
So the sunsetting is impermissible, or...
No, because the sunsetting doesn't involve the commission saying...
Viewability is mandatory doesn't really answer. It's non-responsive to my question.
Well, viewability is mandatory. How you get there is up to the commission's discretion.
The commission is saying... So it's a step two case, then?
It's partly a step one case and partly a step two case. Let me put it this way. The box optional approach of petitioners is foreclosed under step one, okay? Viewability is mandatory. How you do that, the commission offered this choice to cable operators. That wasn't dictated. The choice wasn't dictated. In 3 years, perhaps the commission will figure out another way to get to mandatory viewability. But viewability is mandatory for commercial stations. For non-commercial stations, whether it's mandatory or not, it was certainly reasonable for the commission to read that requirement to be coextensive with the commercial stations. Finally, Mr. Sokler talks a lot about duplicative carriage, and I think it's important to point out here that to the extent there is any duplicative carriage for hybrid systems, that would be the result of the commission's decision in 2001 construing the material degradation statute, a statute that was not part of this proceeding, that wasn't challenged in petitioner's opening brief, to construe that material degradation statute to require carriage of HD must carry channels in HD, in high definition. I would point the court to the NPRM, paragraph 12, where the commission noted that it had previously determined in the first report and order, that's 2001, that a broadcast signal delivered to the cable head end in HD must be carried in HD in order to comply with the prohibition on material degradation. HD is high definition. We continue to require such carriage and reiterate that requirement. That requirement was not reopened as part of this proceeding.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for interveners.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jack Goodman. I represent Interveners National Association of Broadcasters and the Association for Maximum Service Television. Let me address some of the capacity issues that have come up. First thing, Mr. Sokler indicated that should a cable system have to carry a signal in both digital and analog, that would double the capacity that is used. That is not true. The digital signal is carried in half the capacity that the analog does, so the incremental difference is quite small. Also, a large number of television stations are currently carried in both analog and digital. And while the commission asked the question, there was nothing in the record to suggest what the incremental effect of this order might be on any particular cable system. In fact, the only statistics that were put in to the record on the capacity of cable systems were put in by NAB, which showed that the cable capacity is virtually unlimited. And so the assumption that literally having to carry one more digital signal actually forecloses the carriage of something else that a cable operator would otherwise wish to carry is simply not supported by this record. Indeed, the Supreme Court, the three-judge district court in the Turner case on remand said the evidence of impact on capacity even then in a vastly smaller cable universe was so small that had it been any less, there would be no First Amendment argument at all. And indeed, the record shows vast increases. Turning to the question of earlier statements about standing.
That undermines Turner itself, of course.
It undermines Turner to the extent that Turner indicated there would be a First Amendment issue, Your Honor, to the extent it would indicate that if there is no harm, there is no First Amendment issue raised at all. It does not undermine the question of Turner in terms of the holding that if there is a First Amendment issue, the Muskerry statute and the commission's implementation of it is justified. Second, Your Honor, Judge Rogers, you raised the question about the commission's statement that the petitioners used from their 2001 order where they indicated there would be an impact of dual carriage. That was based, again, on an assumed record. The commission actually, in that order, asked for evidence, and the evidence showed there would be no material impact whatsoever. And the 2005 order does not actually repeat that finding after the commission had evidence of the actual impact of Muskerry on cable systems. Judge Kavanaugh, you asked the question about whether a mandatory converter box option would be possible. I believe Mr. Palmore was correct. Effectively, the way cable systems operate, there are two circumstances where a set-top box can be used. In an analog customer may need a set-top box if he or she wishes to get things like premium services, HBO, or video on demand, but that will not carry that will not transmit a digital signal. In order to transmit a digital signal, you would then need, as Mr. Palmore indicated, a digital analog converter box. And at that point, you have effectively created an all-digital system. The cable industry did not want that. It would have required a massive rebuild on a fairly short time schedule. So the commission instead offered the option. It is the same option, for example, that Congress offered satellite carriers in the Satellite Home Viewer Act, and we cite the Fourth Circuit case which upheld that as not imposing any constraints on them because it offered them an option. In answer, Judge Tatel, to your question about the impact, very large cable systems, the commission's data shows that as of 2004, 87% of all cable subscribers were served by systems of 750 megahertz or greater. It was the very largest cable systems. About 2% were small systems, which might have some capacity constraint, but those would now be under 330 megahertz. Those would all be exempt under the commission's fourth report and order.
Are all of those large carriers that are not exempt, do they all carry HD signals?
I believe at this point, I don't have a specific number, but the vast majority of cable operators now offer digital signals and offer at least some HD signals of local broadcasters in their community. Not necessarily all of the same.
Those carriers all remain subject, are not exempt by the Fourth Order.
They would not be exempt by the Fourth Report and Order, but most of them are carrying, for example, under an agreement between the cable industry and public television, most public television stations, which are indeed must-carry stations, are carried in analog and digital now, and therefore this order has no incremental effect on that capacity since it's already used. A large number of local commercial stations, there are some that are not carried, and to the extent those signals are carried, are transmitted in high definition, and on our large cable systems, there would be a modest, extremely modest, incremental effect. But those are the exact reasons the Supreme Court upheld must-carry in the second Turner case, because without that, for viewers that have analog sets, if those signals are now transmitted in digital, they would not be able to view them. And the Commission has consistently said that a cable operator must ensure that subscribers to which it connects must make the signal viewable. The 1993 order that Mr. Sokler referred to is one that said, okay, you don't have to provide a set-top box, but then you're going to have to make it viewable by putting it on a channel where it is viewable that can be seen without a set-top box. So it's very important that the Commission has never wavered and, in fact, has said that it has no power to exempt anyone from this viewability requirement.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
I'll try to be brief. First, as to my homework from Judge Tatel, in the couple of minutes we had during the argument in the joint appendix, the most on-point thing we saw at JA 354, which is the NCTA's submission in the record here, says of the 7,000 cable systems in the United States, there is at most a handful of which we are aware that would meet the all-digital standard anytime soon. So I don't believe, Your Honor, that the record shows that this is a world that come the spring, there's going to be a lot of all digital cable operators. On the standing point, which we've now all gone around on, I think Mr. Palmore's position basically reads out the Supreme Court's assessment of what the First Amendment calculus here, and also reads out from the Quincy Turner decision, the recognition by this court that a programmer doesn't have to show certainty that he or she, that programmer, would have been someone who would be going on but or not thrown off but for the effect of the regulation. With respect to the converter box issue, I don't think we've focused on this afternoon, I should certainly underscore, that the converter box solution is the solution for everybody else. That is, come February, for over-the-air signals, if you have an analog set, you need a converter box. If you subscribe to DBS, you need a converter box. If you subscribe to a telephone company's system, you need a converter box. And as Judge Kavanaugh seems to have focused on, a converter box here avoided the duplicate carriage harm that we're here complaining about. With respect to the Chevron issue, Your Honor, I think we set forth in our brief that when, in fact, this is a new interpretation which was changed and unexplained, and which, unlike a previous interpretation, creates a First Amendment problem, Chevron deference, neither first step or second step, is really appropriate here, that I believe the court's approach should be to avoid the constitutional issue that is being thrust upon us here. And we're not suggesting that a converter box is merely a less restricted alternative. As I think has been said several times this afternoon, a converter box would have meant no duplication of speech, no First Amendment abridgment. If the intermittent scrutiny second prong means anything, this seems to meet it. Thank you, Your Honor. We hope the petition is reversed.
Take the case under advisement.